Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for April 7th, 2008, and on this episode we have an interview with composer Stephen Flaherty. He'll be talking to Tom Williams about A Man of No Importance playing at the Bailiwick. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guest this week is the famous Tony Award-winning composer, Stephen Flaherty. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Tom.
Tell us, I know you're in Chicago to see the Bailiwick production of Man of No Importance. Can you tell us about the show and what brought you to Chicago to see this publication or this production of the show?
Yeah, well, it's a show of mine that it's a personal favorite. I know you're not supposed to have favorites, you know, with your shows. You're supposed to love them equally like children. But this particular piece is a piece that we did in 2002 at Lincoln Center Theater here in New York City. And it's a lovely piece. It's about friendship. It's about the creation of theater. And Bailiwick decided to do the production. And my good friend Bob Ollis is the music director. And so he was sort of filling me in, you know, as rehearsals were getting ready. And it just sounded really exciting. And I know Scott Ferguson, who I had not met, the director, is an associate over at About Face, which is the great Chicago theater that did my Gertrude Stein musical two seasons ago.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. That was terrific.
Yeah, so it sounded like a wonderful you know, production that was coming together, and the opening night was St. Patrick's Day. So St. Patrick's Day in Chicago with a show that you love, I mean, how can you go wrong?
Yeah, Irish show,
that's
with
right.
The composer being an Irish Catholic.
The
only thing is you're
right.
Not from Chicago, you're from Pittsburgh, but we'll forgive you for that.
Yeah.
Tell us what you thought of that production, because I've seen it a couple times, and I thought Bailiwick for non-equity production, I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, it's an interesting show because it's about a group of amateur theater performers putting on a show. And the Bailiwick production, I thought, was just lovely. I thought it was so beautifully sung, and the performances were so heartfelt. And I thought Kevin D. Mays was a wonderful Alfie Byrne, who's the sort of the leading man. He's in the show. Alfie Byrne is a Dublin bus conductor in 1964, who is also the director of the theater. And Kevin did a great job. Fantastic.
So tell us about some of the creatives that went into this. It was originally a film.
Yeah, it was an independent film that came out in the early 90s. And Lynn Ahrens, my regular lyricist partner, and Terrence McNally, the playwright, and I, we had worked together on Ragtime. And we loved the experience of working together with one another, so we were looking for a follow-up piece. And honestly, we thought Ragtime was, in terms of the size and scope of the production, it's sort of as big as you can get. So we thought we wanted to do something that was 180 degrees different for the next piece. So we thought, let's try to do an intimate chamber piece. And Terrence had asked me, he said, what kind of musical world would you like to write for? And I had always wanted to write an Irish piece. You know, I had written some Irish music for Ragtime, but most of it had gotten cut out, you know, in the final draft. So, you know, we were talking what that might be, and I said, Terrence, I said, whatever it is, I don't want to write the potato famine musical. I just don't want to do that. So he said he had brought up this film, A Man of No Importance. He said, had you seen this film? And actually, I think I'm one of the few people that had seen it in the initial run, because it was a very small independent film that starred Albert Finney.
Albert Finney, I remember. I thought it was charming.
Yeah, and Brenda Fricker as the sister. And so we began looking at the film, and the tricky thing was that the film was very realistic. You know, there were literally a lot of kitchen sinks. So in terms of kitchen sink drama, it was very naturalistic. So we knew that for a musical, we had to create some sort of a heightened reality for the piece to exist in. So the thing that was that really turned things around for me and allowed music into the piece was the character of Oscar Wilde, who is just mentioned in the film. And Terrence said, well, maybe he should be a character in the musical version. So in a certain way, he's sort of an alter ego for Alfie Byrne, because Alfie in the piece is a closeted gay man and in 1964 Dublin. So by having Oscar Wilde actually be a fantasy figure in the musical version, that actually gave me license to have Alfie be able to sing his inner thoughts to somebody.
Yeah, and of course, you, what I thought you did marvelously, and you have throughout your career, is how adaptable you are to writing the music of the era or the piece. The only other, let me put you in a category, the only other person that I remember that could do that tremendously well was Richard Rodgers.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting thing. An earlier show of ours, it was actually my first show on Broadway, was a show called Once on This Island, which is set in a fantasy Caribbean island. So it's not really Haiti, it's not really Jamaica. So I was able to create a score that blended different world music, some samba, some South American, some Afro-Caribbean. And it was interesting because when the show was first reviewed off-Broadway, Frank Rich of the Times actually said the same thing. He said sort of my approach to it reminded him of Richard Rodgers working, you know, on King and I, which was really sort of taking his compositional style and, you know, bringing it to, you know, this whole other culture, this whole other world.
Well, you certainly have done that well. And because, you know, there are some composers who write the same score over and over again.
I know.
And we won't mention them, but some of them have had hits of that. But boy, that creative.
But it's funny, you know, whenever you talk about, you know, a composer's style, so much of style has to do with repetition of things that you've already done, you know. And I always try to find new things that are challenging musically for me and also bring out other sides of my personality, you know. So I think my style is maybe adaptability, and I think there is definitely a sensibility. I like to write ensemble-based shows in general. You know, it's what excites me, you know, the idea of a group of people telling a story, you know, rather than, you know, a star vehicle.
Well, I've heard you've been quoted saying that, and you just did say that A Man of No Importance is one of your favorite shows.
It is.
The intimacy, what attracts you to it?
I think of all the characters, I'm sorry, of all the shows that I've written, in a certain way, it's the quietest show, actually. And for a while, it was very challenging getting these characters to sing because all of the characters in the piece have secrets. And, you know, and I know from the Irish that they tend to keep their cards very closely.
Especially you know, in 1964, very conservative Catholic Ireland.
Right, exactly. But I think getting a chance to write for these people was a joy because I was able to draw on a lot of, you know, personal stuff. I mean, my favorite moment was I got to musicalize somebody in the confessional. And it was interesting. I was talking to Lynn. I said the stuff that comes up in the confessional, I said it's terrifying and it's humorous and you know, there are all of these conflicting emotions. So I was really looking forward to writing that. And she said, "Well, you have to lead the way, Stephen. You know, because she's Jewish." So she said, "I've never been in a confessional."
But they, yeah, I could see that. So and you captured it. And tell us the history of the show. Is it ran off Broadway? Is that correct?
Yeah, we ran off Broadway as part of the Lincoln Center Theater's subscription series. So we were in the 2002-2003 season. And the great thing is we were awarded a Best Off-Broadway Musical by the Outer Critics Circle for that season.
That's the major award for that in that category, in that Off-Broadway, correct?
It is, you know, because the Tonys only reflect what's done on Broadway, and when in fact I think a lot of the most interesting or, you know, challenging work happens, you know, either regionally or off Broadway. So
I couldn't agree with you more. So many shows get overproduced just to be, quote, a Broadway show.
Yeah, and if you look even at this Broadway season, last Broadway season, the pieces that are the most interesting and the most individual are things that have either started in the not-for-profit arena, either off Broadway or in the regional theaters.
Yeah, how true that is. So you thought the production at Bailiwick is first class.
It was beautifully done,
wasn't it?
I thought the music direction was very subtle. I love the fact that they don't use microphones. You know, that's almost unheard of in this day and age. You know, so the fact that it's a very intimate piece about these lives, and you want to be really close to the characters. They're not mic'd. You know, you feel like you're really experiencing the story with these particular people, you know, which is great. And I love the physical space there too. It's, you know, it's very, very intimate. So you can, you know, you're right there in the action.
Yeah. And, they were able to put together, the director, Scott Ferguson was able to put together some of our best non-equity, character actors in town. Because we have a stock of strong character actors.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that's fun about the show, because they are all character actors. And it's a tricky show because you have to get highly skilled people to be able to play characters that look like they shouldn't be on a stage, you know?
Yeah.
So that's it's sort of a tricky casting challenge when you think about it.
Yeah, because, they have to be these comic buffoons who really can't act, you know, because it's a play with
right.
an And yet when they sing their song, they got to really nail it.
That's the thing. So it's a fine line, and I thought the score is beautifully sung. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, I do too. Well, it's so nice to see major composers like yourself that come in and support theater.
Oh, it's great. You know, and also, you know, one of the joys of theater is that there's so many different takes on material. You know, and it's a pleasure to see other actors' takes on a role that, you know, that I feel that I know, and they bring out other things that you didn't know were necessarily there, and just seeing how other directors put their own personal stamp on a piece, you know, and that's what is really interesting about theater as opposed to film, because, you know, once you do the film, it's finished. You know?
Right,
it's,
yeah.
Yep.
I agree. Well, a couple things I want to talk to you about in the time we have is, one of them, of course, is the whole process of putting together Ragtime, which... you've got to be honored, because in many, many lists, that's considered one of the great shows of all times.
Well, it was a great opportunity. I mean, it was sort of an interesting story with Ragtime, because we had to audition to get the job to write the score.
Is that right?
It's true. You know, and that doesn't happen very often.
No.
You know, if you look through the history of musicals, you know, you can count on your hand, you know, the couple of times where that's happened, but they all tend to be major shows, because, for example, like Jerry Herman auditioned for Hello, Dolly! To get the opportunity to write that, and Julie Stein, who was, you know, a great Broadway sort of showbiz writer, a lot of producers didn't know that he could write dramatically, so he had to audition as well to write the score for Gypsy. So with Ragtime... up to that point, Lynn Ahrens and myself had had a number of shows produced, and we had had two on Broadway, but we had never written anything on that sort of wild, you know, large panoramic scale, and we hadn't written, you know, what was really a full-fledged drama. So the audition came about because E.L. Doctorow, the novelist who had written the novel Ragtime, he apparently was unhappy with the film version of Ragtime. So he said, well, if I'm going to give the theatrical rights to this piece, I want to make sure that everybody working on it sees the novel the way that I do. Or, you know, he wanted to make sure that their take on it was true to the spirit of the original. So basically what it was is Terrence McNally was on board first, and he had to audition as well. He wrote a 65-page treatment for how he would theatricalize Ragtime. So it contained some dialogue, it contained stage directions, sort of descriptions of scenes, and based on that, we were given that, and the assignment was write four songs based on the treatment. And we wrote four songs, and three of the four are currently in the show.
Wow.
So it was really terrific.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that process, because a lot of people aren't aware of it. You have a book finished.
We had a rough outline.
You had an outline,
right? We had an outline, and we had the original novel, which was so inspirational. I mean, there was such beautiful writing there, and so many great ideas. And the challenge was focusing it.
Yeah,
you know, because you could do it as a mini series. You know, it could be, you know.
Yeah, you got three major stories. Correct.
Right. That's right.
But tell us about I'm always interested in the process. because you do have a book writer and you do have a lyric writer and you have a music writer. I know the old joke used to be, you know, which comes first, and the answer is usually a check from the producer, you know, the Cole Porter answer. But seriously, how do you approach that?
Well, you know, Terrence did his take, like saying, if I were to musicalize it, here's a map of how I might do that, you know, and his big contribution, well, among many contributions, but the interesting contribution was he would have the characters narrate in the third person, you know, so because he really wanted to use a lot of the original Doctorow language in the stage production. So the characters would do a lot of the narration themselves. And then I was actually a ragtime aficionado for years and years, so I sort of did my take of what the ragtime would sound like. You know, I wanted it to be authentic, but yet at the same time I wanted to sort of show the diversity within that particular style. And
yeah, because ragtime's kind of like jazz, and right, it's got a whole range of musical styles.
Oh, it does. And see, that was one of the things I knew would be fun about working on the show, you know, because it could show the difference between the Harlem school of ragtime as opposed to Tin Pan Alley, you know, the kind of ragtime that Irving Berlin wrote, you know, which I got to do in a sequence in Atlantic City. And so I sort of gave samples of basically what I thought the score could be. And then we really sat down to the real work, which was Terrence Lynn and myself sitting in a living room and making the hard choices about who is the main character, you know, what's the main story. And we actually picked one character from each of the three groups. We picked Cole House Walker Jr., who is the ragtime pianist, the character of Mother, who is the matriarch of an upper-class white family in New Rochelle, New York, and Tata, who's the immigrant from Latvia. And we chose those three as the leads, and we knew that every other character or plot point somehow had to impact on one of those three characters. So that was sort of our dictum that we gave ourselves. Whatever we would do, everything had to focus in on one of those three characters.
So then at a given scene, you would create the music that fit that scene, because obviously the Jewish immigrants, that you had more of a klezmer sound.
It was fun writing for them, because whenever I tried to do everything pure music from the old country, it kept sounding like Fiddler on the Roof. That had already been done, and brilliantly. So my take on those characters, where I kept thinking it needed the Eastern European sound and the use of the klezmer, but I also wanted to blend that with ragtime, you know, because basically this is a man from the old country who wants to be a modern American. So that was the interesting thing with that particular score for that character, because this is a man who's literally bridging the old world and the new, and I thought, well, his music should reflect that.
So is that kind of your style when you work with Lynn, that the music tends to come first and then the lyrics come? Or?
Well, I think what comes first is story and dramatic situation.
Okay.
So it would be Lynn, Terrence, and I talking about what is the story, what's the dramatic event, what is the scene going to be about. And, we would discuss that quite for quite a long time. And then usually what would happen is we would separate, and Lynn and I would write a song, and Terrence would write a scene, and then we'd come back and read them for one another. And the beginning of the writing of the show, we actually wrote everything chronologically. So we wrote scene one, scene two, scene three, which is not usually how, you know, a musical is written.
Right.
So much of it was trying to discover how to tell this particular story and how the stories would intertwine. So we thought we should try that. And then once we got the idea of how that would happen, then we began to write other parts of the show, not necessarily in order.
Well, that formula sure produced a great show, because it's spectacular. And we've had a number of terrific productions. And I saw the original, and I saw when it came here in Chicago for the first time, and it was just mind-blowing how good it was. You should be very proud of it.
Thank you. I heard the production at Porchlight was a beautiful production.
It was. It was. And it
told me that.
Yeah, and it ran for like 6 months.
Yeah,
I knew a number of people in the production, and they all just honored the work. They all said that it was just such a joy to do such great material.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Of course, this isn't the first one. You wasn't Lucky Stiff one of your shows too?
Yeah, the very first show that Lynn Ahrens and I wrote was a really weird show called Lucky Stiff that was produced in New York in 1988. And it was a musical farce based on this very obscure sort of comic crime novel. And it's about a young British shoe salesman who stands to inherit $6 million from his dead uncle, and under the provision that he takes the uncle's dead body, prop it up in a wheelchair, and take him for one last wild holiday to Monte Carlo for a week.
I saw a production that Drury Lane Oakbrook did a couple of years back of the show. Here in the suburban Chicago, that was just dynamite. It was very, very funny, and musically very clever.
Well, yeah, that was the tricky thing, you know, because it's a farce. So, you know, farces never stop. So we realized the score could never stop either. So
before we run out of time, I have to ask you about Loving Repeating and that whole process of working with Frank Galati, because it started, I know, at Northwestern, and then there was a terrific production of it about a year later.
So I was really fortunate to... I was asked by Frank Galati. You know, Frank is a huge Gertrude Stein aficionado.
Yes.
And I sort of just knew Gertrude's greatest hits. You know, I was not, you know, the Stein scholar that Frank is by any means. But Frank came to me, and you know, obviously we had worked on a number of occasions. And Frank said, you know, this is something I wanted to do for years. And he felt strongly that there was a misconception about Gertrude Stein, that everybody thought of her as sort of a dry academic exercise. And he said she was actually a very funny person and very lively, and he felt that there was a lot of humor and a lot of fun to be mined, you know, in the work and in the artist. He said that he had not seen on a stage before. So Frank said, what I'd like to do is to take some time off. He had a lot of the writings of Stein. He had letters, poems, speeches, all sorts of you know, different Stein writing. And he said, I'd like to put together a collage using all of Gertrude's words. So that was the given, that there couldn't be a single word in the show that was not a line from Gertrude Stein herself.
Yeah, didn't it help that she wrote those the repeating and the rhymes? Did that help the music?
It was really fun and maddening at times. You know, yeah. And then also it was the first time that I had worked with a dead lyricist. You know,
yeah.
It was a particular challenge. You know, you wanted to say, Gertrude, I really only need 5 words here, and you've given me 20. You know, but it became a really fun project for me. And at first I found it daunting. I said to Frank, I said, you know, let me just sit with it for a while and, you know, see what comes up, see what bubbles up to the surface. And I just found myself getting so attracted to the material, and I had too much of a good time that I realized I had to finish the rest of it.
Yeah, it was, and it turned out to be such a beautiful show. I mean, it was musically sharp. You had some dance numbers. You had a lot of comedy, but it was, I thought it was brilliant. More of a work of art than necessarily a big commercial.
But definitely. It was definitely its own thing. You know, it was. There's no other show that's quite like it. And Frank, another thing of Frank's is he said, I want to have a cast of really young people. So there would be the old Gertrude sort of presiding over the piece, but every other actor would be a very young actor. And so that told me, maybe we should not worry about period style. You know, maybe we should just hop around and we could have jazz and pop music and folk music. And as a matter of fact, Frank told me that her favorite song was this old folk song about it was an old cowboy song, something about the Lonesome Pines.
Okay.
He said so she definitely is, you know, somebody who would enjoy these kind of popular idioms.
Well, that gave you the chance to really, again, do what you do best is write a variety of styles.
Yeah, it was great fun.
All right, in the interest of time, because I know you're on a very tight schedule, tell us what you've got going now, or what your plans are for the next few years, what kind of projects you have going.
Well, believe it or not, we just had a meeting just this afternoon about a new project. There are a couple of ideas that Lynn Ahrens and I are kicking around with different directors and different playwrights, and it's sort of too early to talk about.
Okay, all right.
But I will say that both involve dance.
Hmm.
You know, which is something I've not done yet. You know, I've not done a dance piece, and it's something I've always wanted to do. So I'm really looking forward to that. You know, to creating something where dance is.
Well, for a man who's loves musicals, and I know you wrote your first musical when you were 14 years old.
I did, and it was done in my high school.
Yeah, that had to be cool.
Oh, it was great.
And so we can look forward to a dance show, because I'm a sucker for dance shows. That's one of the reasons I like. Just we talked earlier about when I saw we both saw Drowsy Chaperone. What a great dance show that is! So we need another one.
Well, exactly. So I'm really looking forward to that. So, you know, we're just sort of in the talking stages, but hopefully notes will be coming out soon.
Oh, great. Well, let us know. And it's really a privilege to have you here. And anytime you come back to Chicago, just let us know. We'll probably find a way of getting you on there, because people love to understand that who the composers are. And thank you so much for such a great body of work.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. It's my pleasure.
And folks, thank you for listening, and go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of April 7th, 2008. The Goodman Theater will present the world premiere of The Ballad of Emmett Till, a story told through countless interviews over the past decade with Emmett Till's family, teachers, classmates, and eyewitnesses to the boy's historic 1955 murder. Part history and part mystery, The Ballad of Emmett Till was a world premiere that was developed in the Goodman Theater's 2006 New Stages series. The show will run starting April 26th at the Goodman's Albert Theater and will be directed by Oz Scott. With over 10 years in the making, The Ballad of Emmett Till began as a one-act and eventually expanded into a full-length play in four movements. You can read the detailed history of the play's changes at Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Tickets for The Ballad of Emmett Till can be purchased online at thegoodmantheater.org or by calling the Goodman Theater box office or by following the link at Talk Theater in Chicago's Coming Soon section. Get ready, Chicago! Tickets for the U.S. premiere of the international stage hit Dirty Dancing, the classic story on stage, are now on sale here in Chicago. The national tour of Dirty Dancing will enjoy a limited engagement at the Cadillac Palace Theater beginning September 28th. The show has already enjoyed sellout premieres in Australia and New Zealand, and Dirty Dancing is currently playing to sold-out houses in London and Germany. A production scheduled to open in Toronto this November is already setting record sales in Canada, and now we have our chance here in Chicago. Dirty Dancing is a coming-of-age love story involving the talented and headstrong dancer Johnny Castle and his partner, Baby. The story includes favorite songs like I've Had the Time of My Life, Hungry Eyes, and Do You Love Me? And of course, I'm sure you remember the movie that inspired the story. Dirty Dancing, the classic story on stage, will premiere in Chicago for a limited engagement starting September 28th at the Cadillac Palace Theater. For your chance to get tickets, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Victory Gardens Theater, Chicago's number one presenter of new works, has announced an exciting lineup of two world premieres, a Chicago premiere, a major revival, and the return of its smash holiday hit musical. The Victory Gardens season kicks off October 3rd with the major revival of Eurydice. The show will be directed by Associate Artistic Director Sandy Shiner. Even stronger for the second time around, the Frank Galati-directed The Snow Queen comes back to Chicago on November 28th. The two world premieres will be Living Green, which starts January 23rd, and Class Dismissed, which opens on March 20th. The Chicago debut of Love Person can be seen on May 15th. There are 5-play and 6-play packages available if you are so interested, and all the performances will, of course, be staged at the Victory Gardens Biograph Theater. For more information on the 5-play or 6-play ticket packages, you can call the Victory Gardens Theater box office or visit victorygardens.org Or, of course, click on over to our favorite website, Talk Theater in Chicago. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Stephen Flaherty for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.